This is Malcolm McRae, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 28th of October 2012.
My name is Malcolm McRae. I was born in Glasgow, Springburn, which was a working class area in the north side of the city, and that was in November 16th, 1944.
So now you are how old?
Be 68 next month.
Okay. And what sort of education did you have, Malcolm? Do I call you Malky?
Yes, call me Malky, yeah. It was quite a reasonable education in these days in Scotland. I had a good primary school education. Again, discipline wasn't a problem in these days. The teachers used the belt. They weren't frightened to use a belt, and you knew how far you could go.
Right.
Secondary education, again, I went to what was called a senior secondary. In these days, it's equivalent of English grammar school. Now, the first couple of years were actually quite good. When you went to these schools, you were expected to go in to get your hires. By the third year, the idea of a career in education and being educated was beginning to pull somewhat. Now, in the early 60s, in these days, the Clyde, heavy engineering, the whole of Glasgow was heavy engineering. And I remembered thinking when I was about 16, no, it was 15, because I was going into my fourth year and I thought, oh, do I want another year of this? And I thought, not really. So I then decided, well, I was going to leave school. The next problem was headmaster, parents. You know, why does he want to leave school? And my answer to that one was, well, I'm fed up with it. So, okay, you can leave school. So left school at 15 and a half. Very quickly got a job in Harland and Wolves, which was a big engineering company. They built ships in Belfast, Southampton, and on the Clyde, and engineering works all over the UK. And I started off in the drawing office as a message boy, which was quite interesting. The most embarrassing thing for someone of 15 and a half was in these days in the drawing offices, they had huge rooms, maybe 100 feet long, full of girls who were tracers. The draftsmen in these days did the drawings, the girls traced them, then they were printed and sent out to the shop floor. And these girls loved the chance of heckling any man that came down into the drawing office. Now, what they did, they knew right away, as soon as they picked on you, you were going to have a red face. And the time you got to the end of that drawing office, you certainly had a red face. So, and that was really, after that, 16, apprenticeship. Heavy engineering apprenticeship, fitter turner, ended up as a millwright. And then after that, it was, what do you do with yourself? Now, in these days, down the pool, which is where you get graded to go to sea, got your grading papers. I think I was A was the best, B was the next best, heavy engineering apprenticeship. So I then went to sea. I went to sea for probably, it was about a year near enough, 9 months, 10 months. And I would say it was an interesting experience. I wouldn't say it was one of life's most pleasant experiences, but I learned a lot. Mainly, don't go to sea in tankers. I was actually talking to one of the lads last night about this, and he'd never been in tankers, and he was quite shocked when I actually told him. In these days, you joined the ship. I flew out to Jena, I joined the ship, and the first job we were presented with was on top of what they called the exhaust gas boilers, where basically the ship's engine exhaust went up through a funnel, and round the funnel there were tubes, so it was basically a heat transfer system. Some of the heat from the exhaust was transferred into the tubes, which heated up the water. And these tubes had a habit of leaking. So you were in there with the fumes, big boiler suit, gloves on, everything was very, very hot indeed. You had a plastic bucket, or preferably a zinc bucket, as I found later was the answer. Tools in the water, and a cheap paper mask on to save yourself getting all sorts of noxious fumes. And after 4 hours of that, you were just about dead. You know, the temperature was probably in the 40s anyhow. But for someone coming straight from sunny, cold Scotland into a temperature like that, it was horrendous. And
So it wouldn't take much to tempt you away from that kind of job then?
Well, it wasn't so much that. The hardship, I mean, it wasn't really a hardship for us because we were used to working in temperatures like that and the maintenance side. We repaired boilers and compressors and things like that. And a lot of the work was done. Health and safety wasn't a concern in these days. The main thing was to keep the thing going. And if you had a production line, for instance, compressed air was a necessity because all the hand tools were, or nearly them all were compressed air. So you then had to make sure it was going. And the works manager wasn't interested in the fact it was 45, 50 degrees up there. He wanted the thing going. So the hardship wasn't a problem. What I actually did find was a problem that we sailed from Genoa to Novorossiysk in Batumi in the Black Sea. Now, in these days, Russia was Soviet Russia. So you went into the harbour, there was all the guards, troops, everything. And what really impressed us was on the dock side, the dockers, lots of them were, well, we assumed they were women because they were wearing skirts. But my God, there were some giants of women. The story was that when the winches broke down on the Russian ships, the women were the winches. But it really was quite an experience. And
how did you come to go to the Antarctic then? What was the inspiration for that?
Basically, through the engineering side of it, I met a lad when I was an apprentice who was interested in going climbing. Now, he asked me one weekend, did I fancy going up to Glencoe climbing? And I thought, well, aye, all right, then, Willie, away we go. So he'd got himself a rope and they managed to get another one of the lads. Went up to Glencoe, up the hill, and it's probably the closest I ever came to death climbing, you know, and a very easy route. But it was the usual scenario. Nobody knew what they were doing. Three guys strung across this very easy route, but no idea what to do. But eventually got to the top. And Willie then sort of introduced me to some other guys. And at that time, I was in the TA parachute regiment. And that was taking up a bit of time. I was more interested in that for a while. And then eventually Willie said, look, you fancy going away camping again? So we went up to Skye camping. And then we started to meet other guys. Now, some of the blokes that we met were talking about this group of guys, David Todd, Jimmy Gardner, John Cunningham. You've probably heard these names before. We were down south just now. They were in the Craigdhu Mountaineering Club. And by that time, we started to go up to Glencoe and we managed to inveigle our way into one of the bothies up there, Cameron's Barn. And the Craigdhu had their Jacksonville down the road. And these days, it was quite a small scene, really. So and not a lot to do on a Saturday night except go to the pub and drink. And eventually, these guys came back from the Antarctic. And they're talking away about, you know, it was a great place. And then one of them came in with this fancy ventile anorak, and we're looking at these anoraks, and this was the start of the winter. He said, where did you get that from? He says, great, Antarctic Survey. You know, you go down the gi or your gear that you use, and we're saying, really? What else do you get? And then the thing that clinched it for me was, and you get two Expedition Ferry Down sleeping bags. And I thought, you're a beauty. Because in these days, we were just using millets, what they called thin wool specials. And this was the winter we just came through was 63, which was one of the coldest winters in Scotland. We were basically, every article of clothing that we had, there was no air beds in these days. You put any spare clothing that you weren't wearing in old newspapers underneath you and 3 or 4 pints of local anaesthetic in a pub. So the idea of this sleeping bag thing, that completely clinched it for me.
So that seriously was the reason why you applied?
I mean, I wasn't averse to the Antarctic to me, really, it wasn't probably as much a big deal as it is to lots of these other guys who, you know, especially the scientists, we may never had any real outdoor interest. When we were doing things in the tops of Scottish mountains, dressed in jeans and things that were probably more dangerous than most of the things I ever did down south. Yeah. And the adventure side, that was, you know, it was a bit of a bonus.
Do you remember the interview you had? This would be 68, would it be?
Early 68. Yeah, I can remember. Again, it's a bit hazy, but I can remember bits of it. It was with Bill Sloman at the time, and one of the questions was, well, how did you get down here? Now, there was a rail strike that weekend. I said, well, I just come down on the bus. And he said to me, funny. He said, there's two gap chaps here said they couldn't get here from Scotland. I said, well, I don't know why they couldn't get. So that was that. Another thing.
So that's your initiative?
More or less, well, yeah. Travel, yeah. But I mean, the reason for me going down in the bus, it was cheaper. You know, I didn't know whether you were going to get expenses or not. And there was no way I was throwing money around in these days. So that was fine. And then you had this, what I can remember, but it was pretty cursory medical examination. I think the guy, the doctor, it was Dr. Hayward. I might be wrong in this, but I think that was his name. And the only thing I can remember, it was like a standard army medical, you know, quick look over, look in your eyes, cough, you know, and then that seemed to be it. And then next thing was you got your contract.
Were you surprised to be employed?
No, not really. I wasn't really, because I was aware by the way the interview was going that they had difficulty getting people with, you know, quite broad mechanical knowledge. It was easier to get scientists than to get cooks and mechanics.
So you had an engineering background and lots of mountain experience.
I'd say the engineering background probably was more important, because all the GAs had mountaineering experience in these days. So it was a bit combination of things, but I certainly think that my pedigree from the Clyde and the glowing references I could produce from my employers was probably good enough for that.
So were you appointed as a GA or as a mechanic?
As a tractor mechanic.
Right.
There was a tractor... at that time, I didn't really know what the distinction was. But when I got down south, I found out that basically tractor mechanics... I went to Halley Bay, which was the biggest base. Now, Halley had the generator shed, the diesel mech for the generators. And at that time, we had the three tractor mechs. And, there was one diesel mechanic. So you were basically a tractor mech, but you did everything. You know, that was your main purpose being there. And a lot of that was really ferrying stuff around about the base, although the rest of the base members did that as well. There wasn't a rigid demarcation that you could only do this. You know, you were expected to do the gash and everything, so it wasn't that important to me, really. When it suited you, it was handy being a tractor mech, but there's other times you would rather have been doing something else, but that was life, you know.
What was the first base you were employed on?
Halley Bay. That was... down in the halfway down, well, a third of the way down the Weddell Sea in Coatsland, and that was the biggest British base at the time. I think there was 30 odd guys there. Again, I should have made a note of the numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was at that point in time, Halley, I think it was Halley 2, it was pretty well buried in the snow, so your access to the base, and that was a bit of an eye opener. When you got off the ship, you went up on the Muskeg tractors, and you saw these shafts sticking out from the snow, and entrance to the base, pedestrian access, as it would say nowadays, was down a series of ladders into tunnels in the snow, and that's what the base was.
Were you expecting to be living underground?
I was aware of that. I was aware that that was the main accommodation in the base. And I didn't suffer from claustrophobia or anything like that, so it didn't bother me. And it made sense, because the weather on the surface was pretty foul. And, I mean, after all, rabbits stay down holes to keep out the bad weather, so why shouldn't we? You know?
How were the tractors that you had to become the mechanic of? These were the international harvesters,
I
guess.
International harvesters, and there was Muskeg tractors. The Muskegs were, for those driving sports cars, it would be horrendous, but they were more fun, they were more manoeuvrable, and if you could get them going down a hill, you could get a fair lick out of them. But the international harvesters, they were evidently converted from forestry vehicles with broad tracks, and They were just used around the base for pulling heavy loads, and they were fitted, some of them were fitted with 12-foot broad blades, so you could use them as bulldozers as well. And it was basic maintenance. And in the winter, you would tend to, if you were going to use a tractor out in the field, you would try to strip them down and, you know, make sure they were thoroughly overhauled before you went out in the field. I mean, I now, looking back in it now, a lot of the work was excessive. It really, it wasn't necessary. You know, you've been overcautious, I think. But it certainly filled the long winter's night. You know, there was no problem for something to do.
Were you able to house them in a sheltered environment?
Well, what they had an underground garage, and there was a ramp went down to the garage, which was fine till the first blow. So you got a blizzard, and if it lasted for a week, you had no ramp. So this is where having a few tractor mechanics was handy, and anybody else in the base that was spare. He then went out with a shovel, and basically you always left an international harvester on the surface, or maybe two with their blades, so you can dig out the ramp, basically, to get the vehicles in and out. And any time you needed to get anything in and out, that's what you had to do. So, again, it was quite hard physical work, but kept you fit.
What was it like working on diesel engines at minus 30, minus 40 degrees?
You tried not to work on them, basically. you only did what was necessary, but I mean, it's a fallacy. Lots of the stuff they tell you about and the metal breaks at minus 30. Well, it's a four-letter word begins with S and finishes with T. It may have happened with some metals. I certainly never, ever remember it happening. Mm. But the international harvesters especially had fitted in the cabs what was used at the time to heat buses. I think it was a Webasto air heater that worked on paraffin. There's a pump and, you know, a combustion chamber and a fan. So you blew the hot air into the engines. The idea was, if there was enough in the battery, if the battery went flat, you just get another one from base, from the garage, humped it across the snow and put it in. And when you got the heating going, you heated up the engine, and then you just put in an ether cartridge you can put in to the a little holder, pressed it in, and it fed basically neat ether to the cylinders. Turned it over and away it went. I mean, well, sometimes it wasn't just as easy as that, but it certainly wasn't a problem. You could also utilise that if you were working in a vehicle. I mean, only an idiot would work in an engine with a heater switched off. You know, if you could get the heater going first, that was half the battle. No wind, stick a blow lamp or a primus stove or something underneath it and build a wee snow shed round it. The same in the field with the muskeg tractors. If you were going to service it, you try to pick a good day. And if it said your oil had to be changed, say, every 50 hours, well, if it was 55 or whatever, tough luck, you know, or even 100, you would do it when you had a chance. So,
were the muskegs reliable?
Yeah, I would say they were. Yeah. I'm actually trying to think. You had a few problems with them, but most of the problems were related to fuel. If you got water in the fuel, there was a carburetor bowl. The water could freeze in the carburetor bowl. But once you knew what it was, you just get a blow lamp, heat up the carburetor bowl, and, you know, play a blow lamp over the manifold. And again, not to be recommended in the UK, but that's what you did. Blow lamps, if you were good with them, you could start almost anything. The big killer was wind. If you were outside in the field trying to start something and it was really windy and cold, then it would be more difficult. But I mean, I'll come on to it later. It was on other bases where I had more problems with that sort of thing. But Halley wasn't a particularly difficult base, really, to work on. It was time-consuming with everything but under the surface. Another problem was, of course, everything on the surface drifted over. Fuel, food, etc. But the dumps were marked, and if you needed the stuff, got a sledge, towed it out, and two or three would dig it out or use the bulldozers to clear it. So I wouldn't say it was a major problem. The major problem was that the ice pressure underneath the snow was compacting, turning into ice. You got heat spots where warm air escaped into the chambers. The chambers then formed around the buildings, and then you get icicles started to form, and then the icicles started to press through the roof. But I mean, there was another old base, Halley 1, which you would just used to go down. You'll have heard of it as well. Down the ladders into Halley 1, and it was like Santa's grotto, about 60 feet underground. And these icicles through the roofs, and pianos, and ice grottos full of crystals. Quite scenic, actually. As a matter of fact, I just wish probably that particular time taking more photographs, but all that's happened now with the photographs, they lie in boxes at home. Every other fiddle have told you the same thing. Mm. It's all in record, but you don't know where it is now.
So were you able to access the spares you needed for these machines? I'm not just thinking of Halley, I'm thinking generally now. You said you had problems elsewhere.
They had most spares that you would need. And the other thing was you could make a lot of stuff. We had a small workshop that we had a lathe and lots of bits of spare metal and things like that. So if you were reasonably good with a lathe, you could certainly make things or fabricate things. I mean, I can't actually remember any vehicle being unusable because we couldn't improvise or didn't have something. Although we had one vehicle that was not in the official inventory. and you'll have heard of this from the Halley Fids. It was a Lansing snowmobile.
Go on.
It was basically a chassis with four skis on it and an aircraft engine in the back of it, which had been sent down in the early days of Halley, the idea being for a quick evacuation. If someone had an accident in the field, this thing, aircraft engine, they used them in Canada, they could just blast across the snow, arrive and take the casualty away. Well, I don't know if it was ever used for that, but certainly it had been buried under the snow for quite a long time. And one of the lads before us, a guy called Abdul, he's the electrician. There was two guys, Abdul and Johnny Carter. They were down the first year I was at Halley. They had just finished the third winter in Halley, which explained a lot what was going on in their brains, but that's by the point. So they dug it out and got this thing going. And what you used to do with it was, Abdul was pretty jealous of his machine, but occasionally you would get a wee shot if you were lucky. And how it was started was that you basically poured ether into it, lay across the engine, got a hold of it and swung it, the propeller by hand, hoping it will fire and not take your head off. And it had a total loss oil system because the seals were away on it. And what you did was you just filled it up with old oil and you blasted across the bundu, leaving a trail of oil, you know. Totally non-PC now, but in these days it didn't matter. And it was lots of fun, apart from when you used to rip up the telephone cables down to huts out in the bundu and things.
So, how do you mean? So you would accidentally...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. What actually happened was they had, there's a place called Mobster Creek, and they had a sledge. It was called a caboose. It was a sledge, just like a wooden hut built on it. You could go down there and a few emergency supplies in case you get stuck there. And also, the other thing about Mobster Creek in the winter, there was an emperor penguin colony, which was a good day out for the troops. But the idea had been they could run basically field telephone cable the same as the army did. And which they probably buried when they put it in, but the snow soon took care of that. And one particular incident, went down to Mobster Creek, came back, and the guy that was driving the thing said to me, "Something wrong with this thing, it's dragging in the snow." Aye, it was dragging in the snow, right? There's probably about half a mile of telephone cable dragging along behind us. And they took care of that, just cut it off and dumped it, so...
Did you have to spend much time out in the field, or were you really tied to base?
No, I was actually involved in field trips from Halley Bay. I think it was in two field trips from Halley. The first one was with a thing called a Fox Track motor sledge. Went out with a surveyor, and that was my first real introduction into Antarctic travel, and it was quite interesting. You knew about crevasses and things like that, but you weren't actually in Scotland. You didn't come in across lots of crevasses. Mm. You came across bergschrunds, but I'd been to the Alps and places like that, and you knew to be careful, but you hadn't actually been driving anything over them. So you basically had a thing, it was like a pole with a chisel in the end. It was called that bog chisel. And all you did was you probed in front of you and found what you thought you could drive across and do that. But that was an introduction into camping, which probably for most people, to camp in the Antarctic, it would be, you know, horrendous. But he actually had very good tents. And I mean, I thought they were very good tents. And he also had these wonderful fairy down sleeping bags, which was the whole purpose of being there, you know. So certainly in the early days, this would be probably towards the end of the summer, the temperatures were quite high. I mean, probably minus 10, 15. Well, it wasn't particularly cold. And that was really my first introduction to that. And, of course, on the way back, the fox track broke down and it had to be rescued. Again, that was an introduction into how reliable fox tracks were. But this was in the early days of the survey using motor sledges. They had used a thing called an Eliason motor sledge before that, which had roughly the same pedigree of reliability as the fox tracks. But being an engineer, that's what you were there for, so you might as well fix it.
Did you pick up much about the science that was being done? Did you talk to scientists? And...
Yeah, you would work with them as well. You would give them a hand. There was ionospherics, meteorology, geophysics, and there had been glaciology. There was survey there and geology. So you would give people a hand and they would give you a hand. There was no rigid demarcation about what you could or could not do. It wasn't... It was a very good place. If you were interested, you could learn an awful lot. And I actually found that quite an interesting experience, just watching what the Met Men did with how you put the balloons out and the survey, the odd lights. That's when I actually learned how useful trigonometry was and wish I'd paid a lot more attention to it at school. But I did rectify quite a lot of that later on. Certainly the scientific side at Halley was quite far advanced. And at that particular time, 69 was a maximum sunspot year, which then meant you had wonderful aurora. And
you saw that, didn't you?
Oh, we did. And what we used to do, as you were a tractor driver, the international harvesters had a large cab on them, and in the top of the cab there was an escape hatch. You opened the escape hatch in the winter, started up the engine, put the heater on, and you just sat there and you watched all this. But with the rest of the base, we couldn't get in your cab. When your pals couldn't get in your cab, the rest were hurled round outside trying to keep out the wind. And a superb display. It was in a wonderful place for taking photographs, because your camera didn't frost up because it was inside. It was only when you took it out that it did. So that
was one. I've heard of an international harvester being an observatory before.
Oh, yes. Well, that's what you've got a brain for. Yeah.
So would that happen a lot? Would you be out there a lot? Or just on rare occasions?
If there was anything worth looking at, yes. Another thing we did in the winter, this idea that the winter is permanent darkness, is a load of rubbish.
Really?
Because you've a large, probably just about midwinter, dead on, you'd have very little light. But on each side of it, the sun, although the sun was below the horizon, you had absolutely, you really need to see it to believe it, absolutely beautiful crimson sky. Everything was crimson snow. And you would go down to visit the Emperor Penguin colonies. And you'd probably, if you drive down with a muskegon or an international harvester and walk down to the colonies. And the colonies were a fantastic sight, because the penguins huddled together, and above them you had their breath, and it was an absolutely beautiful crimson glow, you know, with the light shining through it.
Through the
breath.
Yeah.
It was like a sort of crimson cloud balanced in their heads. But then the other thing we then found was you would go down to the colony, and here and there they were abandoned eggs. So you could get your emperor penguin egg to bring home, but there's another lesson we learned very quickly there. On the edge of the colony, these colonies were not, as we discovered, completely static things. And in one particular occasion, we dumped all our gear at the edge of the colony and it went away round to the other side of the colony to get what we thought were better photographs. Of course, the penguins had started to... As we went round, they tended to shuffle slightly back from us. By the time we got back, where was our stuff? So, I mean, again, not politically correct. It was a bit of chucking penguins out the way till we finally got our gear.
You know? So you had to wade into the...
Oh, more or less, yes. Another problem was the smell. The penguin guano absolutely stank. It wasn't too bad in the winter, but certainly if you went down in the spring when the sun was starting to get to it was gas mask time almost. But you got, like all things, you got used to it, you know.
Sounds like you had a great time at Halley. So how come the move to Fossil Bluff for the second year?
Well, Halley, that's the good side. Halley had been underground for quite a lot of the... or under the snow for quite a lot of the year. You won't get any group of men anywhere without some sort of tensions. And there was certain tensions, but it was a bit limiting for me. And I'd actually went down on the ship to the Antarctic, there was other guys going to other bases, and I knew you could transfer bases, and I'd always had the idea in the back of my mind, well, transfer base. Now, there was a base called Fossil Bluff, which, again, you'll have heard of. It sounded more like my type of base. You know, it was basically a hut about 12 foot square, four bunks, workbench, Rayburn, and the toilet was a tent out in the Bondu, which was no big thing. But I put a request for a transfer and got transferred to the Bluff. And that really was much more my scene, because where I start, even out in the ship, went to Stanley, and then you went transferred and then headed down the peninsula and the Bisco, and then another way down, you're going to the other bases, seeing guys you'd been down with. You were then getting involved in the sealing. That was another thing that was... I don't actually know if that would have been allowed now, because you know yourself, they were killing 200-300 seals for dog food, which again, in these days, as there was no commercial sealing going on, no big thing, unless you were a seal, it wasn't a problem. And again, that was something that I'd worked when I was in Glencoe sometimes, and with the stalkers, they used to bring the stags off the hills, and they would gralick them, which is basically, it wasn't a lot different from gutting seals. My father, he'd been a Highlander, and he showed me how, you know, you snare rabbits, and it wasn't any great disaster. And shooting the seals was quite an interesting thing as well, because at that time they were doing... It depended what scientists were on board and what specimens they were looking for, but they were, at one particular point they were collecting internal parasites, mainly out of crab eater seals. So you then had your jars of formaldehyde, and you would open up the stomachs of the crab eater seals and see what was there, and anything interesting went into the jar, and away it went. And then if you shot a leopard seal, this was a whole box of goodies, because the teeth were removed, the jaws were removed, things like that. Brought home as souvenirs. So the whole way down the peninsula was very interesting, because there's quite a lot of historic stuff. South Georgia, that was an absolutely fantastic place. In South Georgia, I could actually quite happily have spent a lot more time on, because I've always been very interested in the whaling industry and the Norwegian and Scottish side, and here it was all on your doorstep. And my brother, he'd been a radio operator at sea, and it'd be 65, I think, 64 or 65, he went down to South Georgia for 2 years, not with a survey, but with the Falkland Island Dependency Survey, which were the guys that were running it at the time. So the main reason for not doing that at the time was I thought South Georgia would be too limiting as an island. Big mistake, but it doesn't really matter, you know. So there's always something new and something interesting. The next thing, of course, was when you arrived at Adelaide. You know, that was the hub of the airport. That was our Antarctic airport, and basically the way into Fossil Bluff was by air, which certainly was, again, not... I didn't find it anything odd about that, because I'd, as I said, been in the TA, and I was used to jumping out of aeroplanes, so being in them for longer wasn't any problem. Certainly the... At the Adelaide side, it's quite good fun, you know. There's plenty of things to do in Adelaide, and there's plenty of laughs there, but I won't go into that. But a lot of them were drink-fueled, needless to say, which the survey probably wouldn't have liked at the time.
But you were just passing through Adelaide?
Yes, on the way down.
This particular year, yeah. Which was 1970,
yes.
To go to Fossil Bluff.
Yes.
Was the work very different to Fossil Bluff from Halley?
Not particularly, because Fossil Bluff... was set up, it's mainly glaciology. So when I was down there, the first, when I arrived there, there was a guy, George Kistrick, who you'll know, Paul Girling, he was a surveyor. George was a glaciologist, Paul was a surveyor. George Kistrick was, and Brian Hill was a GA, and I was there as a sort of tractor mech. They had a 2 muskeg tractors that had been driven down over the sea ice in the early 60s and had stayed there. And we had a fox track, the same as the version that we had at Halley Bay, which a previous experience proved quite useful. So what we were doing, basically, we were there to support George in his glaciology, and Paul Girling, the surveyor, was doing astrofixes at the time, which was before GPS satellites. They had a position and they were taking sunshots, star shots to accurately fix the position at that point as a reference point for triangulation in the area. So it doesn't sound a lot to spend a winter and a summer doing, but that certainly covered it.
So when the time came to return to the UK because your contract was over, were you leaving the Antarctic, you thought, for the last time? Or were you always already intending to return?
No, I thought, I could probably go back then, unfinished business, yes. But I thought I'd see what it was like. I mean, when I went home, I didn't go straight home. I got off the ship in South America and travelled up through South America. And I actually, what I'm still surprised to this day, that I didn't end up staying there, because I found it very, very interesting. And it sounds rather odd, but the people were much more, I would say they were much more open and much more friendly. They didn't have this sort of facade that you have in the UK where everyone's reserved. People would be open with you and you could be open with them. But, no, it certainly wasn't... the end of it. But
did you have to reapply?
I basically at the time I came back and I thought, right, what am I going to do? And I had a half offer of a job up in the North Water Project up in Baffin Bay, and I sort of swithered about that. But I then went and applied. I went into the office, and I think it might have been Eric Salmon at the time, I think his name was, and he sort of more or less said, "Do you fancy going down south and, you know, your pals?" And I thought, okay, so yeah, so that was me back enrolled again. But that was quite an interesting time, actually. We left the UK, did the usual, the Falkland Islands, everybody got drunk, you know, the usual scenario. Got down as far as... I got off in South Georgia and spent some time in South Georgia, which was quite interesting because there was a guy there, a boatman, came from the Shetlands, and there was one incident I always remember. It was a really wild day and we were sitting in the old shack house and it had a huge big... plate glass window, and someone says, "Christ, there's Bob out in the boat, and here was Bob roaring like the clappers in this boat. And we thought, shit, he's got swept out. So there was a big rush down to get a launch gun and what have you. So
Bob.
Bob Clunas, I think is his name. And this is what you recollect. But they got the launch out to Bob and asked Bob, we'll tow you in. And Bob says, no, I'm out here fishing. Bob was rowing up and down, trawling a line to try to catch North Athenia. But, you know, that was the sort of thing that went on. But after that, there's various ports of call. I mean, I couldn't detail them all, where you went, Cygne and all these places, but we ended up at that time, Anvers Island, they were talking about making a sort of staging post for some of the aircraft. So, in Anvers Island, the Bazool base, now I've forgotten the number, what it was called, but there was quite a lot of work needing to be done in the base, and I went basically ashore. They had generators and things like that. So the idea was pussyfoot about and get the generators going and things like that. And another couple of lads were there. We're still around, and I'm not going to get into their names. This is as far as this story will go. But they'll know who I'm talking about. But we started paint stripping and things like that. And they were busy getting on with their paint stripping, and I was busy pussyfooting about, playing with the generators and things. And I got a radio call from Adelaide Island, from the base commander. They were having a problem with a muskeg, and they asked me, would I go down and give the mechanic a hand? All I'll say is I'm not sure why he couldn't do it himself. But anyhow, I arrived down there, and the muskeg problem was solved very quickly, as I knew it was going to happen. So I was then at Adelaide, and probably the idea at the time would have been back to go back to Anvers. But I always remember he was trying to put a drill on a bench, and the Jenny shed. No, it wasn't the Jenny shed. I think it was a tractor shed, which was different. It was another shed. And they hadn't mounted it properly. So that was my job, and one of the jobs in the Clyde, do it right. If it wasn't right, it was annoying me. So I was cutting a bit of metal and a vice. And in these days, this is where it gets technical, you get different types of hacksaw blades. The old nasty ones were very brittle and they broke. One of them broke, a bit sprang back into my eye, and that was that. So there was a bit of humming and hawing about what to do, and it would be about 2 weeks, I think it would be, tails going backwards and forwards between London and Adelaide, and eventually it was, in brackets, decided that with bits of pressure from certain people, again, that's all I would say, that certain people could well have put quite a lot of pressure on what was going on in London at the time, because the problem with the type of injury I had, so I was told, it could spread to the other eye. So you're then sitting there full of painkillers and a bum, you know, it's covered in bruises with injections, antibiotics. It went to decide what was going to happen, but eventually it was decided it would be better if I was evacuated back to the UK.
What time of year was this?
This would be in the summer.
Okay.
Again, it would probably be, what I mean by summer, it would probably be November, December, something like that, that's Antarctic summer.
Did you concur with the conclusion that going...
Oh, yeah. I would say visually impaired big time at that point, because I had an eye that I couldn't see out of, plus there was a cataract in it, because what had actually happened is the lens envelope had been punctured it was becoming opaque. There was a chance of sympathetic ophthalmia. And the last thing I wanted to come back from the Arctic was with a white stick and a permanent dog, you know. Mm-hmm. Although you can, it's a lot easier to solve these problems. Now, they were solvable at the time, but...
How did they get you out?
Well, that was another interesting thing. The idea was to fly me up to... Where did they fly me to? I think it was Anvers Island. I'm a bit vague, but basically flew me from, it would have been Adelaide to Anvers Island, but taking off, it could have been Anvers Island I was flying from. Anyhow, wherever I was flying from at the time, I'm getting a bit big. We had a great deal of difficulty getting the plane off because of crosswinds in the runway. And they were heading down the runway and they'd get a gust of wind and then the plane would slide sideways. But evidently, the plane, when it dropped off the end of the pediment, it took off. That was us on our way. So we got up to, it would be Anvers probably, got off at Anvers and transferred to the John Biscoe. Now, the John Biscoe was then detailed to take me up to the Drake Passage, where the Chilean ship, the Palato Pardo, was going to pick me up and take me up to Ushuaia. So what actually happened was we were in the Drake Passage and it was pretty rough, and the Palato Pardo was just steaming in slow circles, and they sent a launch out. Now the Biscoe, the launch went round to the lee side of the Biscoe. I got into the launch, and then they headed back towards the Palato Pardo. But now the weather was getting really bad, so. What actually happened was that they dropped two falls down, and that's basically fore and aft hooks to put round the launch and started to lift it up. And what actually happened was the forward fall came off, so the launch then fell and was hanging with the bow in the water. And by this time, John Cole, the captain of the Biscoe, had spotted what was going on. He swung the ship around and created a bit of a lee, and they chucked a rope down, and the rope round me, and up I went, and then they rescued the two crew members, and then they pulled the launch up. But it was quite a close thing, because if it went into the sea then, it would have been in big trouble. And then it was up to Ushuaia, and then flew from Ushuaia to Buenos Aires, which, having been through South America previously, my Spanish was good enough to travel by and understand what was going on. Picked up by the embassy car, and then taken from the docks up to the embassy. Spent the night in the embassy, then flew into London the following day, I think it was, and hung about for months that summer, just getting waiting for the eye to operate, to get operated on, and operated on, and that was really the end of that bit of the story anyhow. But it certainly made a difference. I didn't realise just how awkward it was to adapt to not having proper full binocular vision.
Is that still the case?
It is now, but I don't notice it now.
Why was it so important to get you back to the UK to do the operation? Why couldn't the operation take place?
There had no facilities, no equipment for doing that. I mean, bus facilities were very rudimentary. I mean,
what about Buenos Aires? Or
again, when you're back in Buenos Aires, you might as well come to the UK. Yeah. But I mean, there was another thing to harp back a bit from that. When I was at Fossil Bluff, there was Fossil Bluff, it was a 4-man base, and we had an accident. One of the lads fell over an oil drum and split his knee open. And Alan Milne was a doctor in Adelaide Island, and at that time the advice was, give him a local anaesthetic, get a toothbrush, scrub the wound clean and then stitch him up. Well, it was actually a pretty big wound. It split his kneecap completely. Not the kneecap, but the flesh in front of it. And there's quite a lot of tweezer work, removing the bits of the gravel and stuff out of it. And then basically, Paul wasn't too happy about the operational side of it. So to get around that, we got a bottle of rum and we got half a bottle of rum into him and then gave him the local anaesthetic and stitched him up. And when Alan saw it, when he came down and the plane, when the planes arrived, he was quite impressed with the job. I mean, I've actually seen the job since, and I was quite impressed with the job I did at the time.
Just going back to your evacuation briefly, there's a note here about an interesting trip in the Beagle Channel. Was that?
That's the one. That's where.
So the transfer took place quite close to.
Oh yes, yeah. Okay. It was quite a close run thing because of the weather, and had we been into the sea, it would have been quite difficult, I think, in the conditions to have recovered us.
Did you fear for your life at that point?
Not really. You're too busy just getting. You know, you're too busy trying to preserve it to worry about fearing for it.
There's a couple of other incidents I want to ask you about. Again, this is back at Halley. When one of the tractors fell into a crevasse on the hinge.
That was my second field trip. Now, that was actually quite... It was an interesting experience because what had actually happened was we'd set off to... I think it was a depot run. And at Halley Bay, you had the Brunt Ice Shelf, and there's an area called the Hinge Zone where there was inland ice and the floating ice. And what actually happened was the movement of the ice created crevasses, and the crevasses covered with snow, and the idea was there was a steep route through the crevasses, but obviously these things change all the time. So what you tended to do is you would drive along, and if the light was right, you would look for any signs of irregularities. You soon became able to pick them up quite quickly, mainly because you didn't want to make too many mistakes. And if you thought there was something wrong, you get out your ice chisel, your bog chisel, poked away to check to see what there was. Now, what had happened was the area we were crossing, I don't think we'd considered it particularly difficult to cross. So there were signs of crevasses, but most of them were well bridged. Now, at the time, fortunately, I was driving a Muskeg tractor, and I drove across this crevasse. Now, the normal wisdom was, don't drive straight in the tracks of the guy in front of you, because if you were going to weaken the bridge, the second guy would come along. But the trouble was, I think the International Harvesters, they were significantly heavier than the Muskegs. The Muskegs, I think, would probably be about ton and a half. The International Harvesters could be maybe 3-4 ton. Again, I should have made a note of all this before I came here.
We got the gist.
But I was looking at the mirror and I could see my tracks in the snow, and I looked again in front and I looked back and I could see a guy called Norris Riley. Norris was driving to the side of the tracks where he should have been, and the next thing I looked, I saw the top of the cab in the mirror, and I thought, what the hell's going on here? And what had actually happened was Norris had driven over, and it was very unfortunate. That particular point he'd chosen to drive over, it was a junction of three crevasses, and it was like underneath, it was like a dungeon, you know, one of these bottle dungeons. You had it narrow at the top and widening at the bottom, and of course with the tracks going, the International Harvester just churned its way down. Now, on the top of these International Harvesters, as I said, there was a hatch in the roof, that was the escape hatch. Now, Norris was up and out that like a rocket and on the sledge at the back. And what actually happened was the International Harvester dropped, the sledge jammed it, and then the engine cut out. So we were then faced with a scenario. Well, we've got a tractor down the hole, boys, so what do we do? We had a look at it, and it was obvious with the gear we had at the time, if we'd moved that sledge, which we would have had to get it out, that would have went right down the hole. And the next thing was, well, what we're going to do? Well, a bit of humming and hawing. And I was looking in the cab. I could actually see where I was standing over the edge of the hole. You're not stupid. You don't go straight over. You probe the edge to see where the edge of the hole is. And I could actually see Norris's camera, which was a Hasselblad. And I says to him, Morris, is this? Norris, you've left your camera down there. And he's pretty shaken at this point. He says, me, says, oh, I don't know. I don't want to. No, no, it can stay down. And I thought, again, the Scotsman, bugger that. That's too good a camera to leave down there. So we got one of these electron ladder things. It's basically a little wire ladders with aluminium rungs, and we dropped that down. So I got a rope down myself, and the idea being if the tractor goes, I'll just, if it goes to the side, I'll go to the side and it can drop away and I'll be in the rope. So I got the camera up. So Norris had said to me, if he ever hears this, he probably won't remember saying it, but he certainly did say to me, well, it's yours then. Well, I mean, obviously, I had a perfectly good camera at the time, so I just gave it back to him, but it shows you how shock can affect someone's brain, you know.
You were breaking every health and safety rule in the book that was yet to be written.
Well, was there a... Yeah, but health and safety... See, I disagree with this modern idea that you can legislate for everything, rules can cover everything.
But common sense would have suggested you should leave it where it was.
No.
Yeah?
What was it? What? That tractor was stuck. There was a tractor, maybe 2-3 ton stuck. What difference was my weight going to make to what was going on? You would, in the grand scheme of things, it's like anything. You look at it, leave it for a bit and see what happens. Nothing happened. I was going down a ladder. I mean, I'm not being foolhardy about it. I was going down a ladder, had a rope on, had more, I'd say 60, 70, 80% chance of surviving in it, but any scenario, you need to be unlucky. So why not do it?
Did you get the tractor out?
Well, that's what actually happened with that tractor was a person you're going to interview later, Gordon, he'll be able to tell you exactly how they got it out. But yes, they did get it out, and that was a very impressive operation.
There was another occasion where you very nearly went over an ice cliff.
That was, that again, was this was just the sort of thing that could happen in the conditions we were driving in. And it wasn't a particularly dangerous area. It was a well-flagged route, but it did go reasonably close to ice cliffs. Now, what actually had happened was we were travelling in not very good weather, and it was a whiteout. It was blowing, and we could see a reasonable distance in front of us. But again, a lot of the time, we just lose sight of the surface. But what we had, and it was a Muskeg tractor I was driving at the time. That there's another lad there, Dick Palmer. He was driving a Muskeg about 10 feet opposite me. We were driving basically side by side, and we had two co-pilots with another couple of lads, and we were sitting inside the cabs, and eventually Dick, he must have looked at his watch, because I think it was coming up at 7 or 8 o'clock, whenever the sked was, so the point that the watch went, so stopped the Muskeg, and I was talking to, I think it was a guy, his nickname was Grunge, I think it was, and I'd said to him something about, I'll nick across and see what we're doing. So I opened the door of the tractor, and they had a thing called a crevasse frame made of scaffolding round about it. So I was hanging onto the crevasse frame, just having a look before I jumped down, because the other notorious thing was a Muskeg will sit across a crevasse quite the thing, because it's got a far lower ground pressure than someone on foot, and the idea was not to drop down straight into the surface, because we'd almost lost Dick earlier on that trip with us. But anyhow, I saw what I thought was a line, and I thought, what's that line over there? And it was just like one of these films where a curtain opens, and here we were, certainly no more than 60 or 70 yards, probably less, from the edge of these ice cliffs, which were probably 150 feet. And had it not been for that particular sked, and had it been a complete whiteout, probably at least one of us would have went into the sea, if not two of us. So all you would have had then was just a line of tracks disappearing. But that wasn't the end of it, because when we actually stopped the tractors, and the first thing that happened, Dick's tractor had been fitted with a new electronic ignition system for that trip. They were just coming out then, and could he get the bugger to start? No. And there we were, stuck in these ice cliffs, not very far from the edge, with a tractor that didn't start. But I took mine back and then came back, but eventually we did get it going. But that was probably, you know, the dividing line between something going wrong and something not going wrong.
Having had a close call, sometimes Bass changes practices to avoid.
No, I don't think we ever bothered reporting that. I can't honestly remember. That's the sort of thing that you just. You obviously would not report every incident.
But you're
to
less
Bass.
Than 100 yards from death, aren't you?
Well, yeah, every time you cross the road, you're less than 100 yards from death in the UK. It's all. You've got to balance it up.
We haven't talked about Stonington, so finally. You went to Stonington for the winter of 73. Is there anything that stands out in your memory from your time at Stonington?
Stonington, I wouldn't say as enjoyable as being down, you know, down the peninsula, but I didn't particularly like working with the dogs, much to my surprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
Part of it was I didn't like the way. I mean, I'm aware of the way the dogs were handled. You had to handle them roughly, but I've probably empathised a lot more with the dogs than I did with some of the guys. So I'll leave that one at that. But Stonington actually, really for me, gave me a really good, probably end to my Antarctic career when I went back to Alexander Island, with an area that I'd always wanted to go to at the Bluff. That was when a guy called Chris Edwards, he was geologising above the Georgia Sixth Sound onto the Milky Way and Planet Heights and all that. And that was Alexander Island in the centre was an absolutely superb area. I mean, I'd worked there with some of the geologists and geophysicists when they'd come down when I was at the Bluff originally. There's huge sections that are not in this report or what I'm telling you just now, but that was really the best time working in Alexander Island, because you had this generally good weather and magnificent scenery and quite interesting geology as well, because at that point Chris found a place called Atoll Nunatak, double-ended quartz crystals, which were quite unique. And I actually remember, I think I spent something like 4 days doing very little plain tabling and an awful lot of time mining quartz crystals. That was certainly one of the highlights, I would say.
What became of the crystals?
I've still got them at home.
You've got them?
Oh, yes. Oh,
yes. How does the Antarctic rate in the life of Malky?
I would say it was a very interesting interlude, but not anything I would have thought was terribly unusual. It was something that was like an actual progression. Mm. And at the time, that was the best time. I now know that the years probably between 65, 75, and most of the blokes that were down at the same time as me would say they reckoned they were the best years, because the system was more or less worked out with virtually no control from London. What London wasn't told, they didn't know. So we did what we did. The guys got the programmes done and we got our jollies, and there was plenty changing around. You know, you could learn how to use a theodolite, which I did, and, you know, the George who worked on base, George was an excellent mechanic, although I think since he came from the Antarctic, his skills seems to diminish since he got married. But certainly a very interesting thing, but not, I would say, the defining point in my life. I mean, I've always tried to look forward, not back.
It's been great looking back there today. Thank you very much indeed.
No problem, Chris.
Thank you.
I hope it's of some use to
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. You're eloquent.